The court calls United States v. Ellis Puro. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker. Good morning, honorable members of this honorable court. I'm Captain Isaac Kennan. I'm joined today by Colonel Pat Wells, and we represent the appellant, Aaron Ellis Puro. May it please the court. In Brown v. Ohio in 1977, the Supreme Court ruled that the Fifth Amendment forbids successive prosecution and cumulative punishment for a greater and lesser included offense. The Supreme Court also ruled in Schmuck v. United States that a lesser included offense exists when it is impossible to commit the greater without first having committed the lesser. Your Honor, that's what we have in this case. It is impossible to prove the greater offense of abusive sexual contact without first proving the lesser offense of wrongful sexual contact.
Okay, before you get into that,
yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't this whole issue waived?
Your Honor,
the defense admitted at trial it wasn't an LIO. Stated in open court it wasn't an LIO. Judge said, you're right. Everybody agreed it's not an LIO. Now here we are saying it's an LIO. Why isn't it waived?
Your Honor, the appellant contends that this honorable court's decision in United States versus Harwood is controlling on that issue, that this court has found that when trial defense counsel raises a motion or an objection on the basis of multiplicity for sentencing, that preserves review for multiplicity issues. Additionally, trial defense counsel.
Most of this was unreasonable multiplication of charges. It wasn't multiplicity. You said at trial it was not an LIO. That sounds like waiver to me.
Your Honor, the appellant's position is that trial defense counsel was mistaken. The trial defense counsel misread this court's opinion in Jones to require a very strict wooden formality in applying the elements test that the Supreme Court set forth in Blockberger.
So he was just wrong.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so he didn't make a knowing waiver because he didn't know what he was doing.
Yes, Your Honor, that the waiver was not knowing and intelligent, Your Honor.
All right.
No, did not the military judge indicate that it should go up on appellate review?
That is correct, Your Honor. The military judge stated that it is reasonable that if there is a conviction on both, both should go up to the appellate court to deal with.
Thanks.
And therefore, would that have informed the defense counsel's view as to whether there was a necessity to object?
Your Honor, I think it would be fair to conclude that the defense counsel at that point believed that the issue had been preserved for appeal regarding unreasonable multiplication of charges, as you pointed out, Judge Stuckey, and also regarding his motion for multiplicity for sentencing, which, of course, this court has found in Campbell that there is only one multiplicity, and multiplicity for sentencing encompasses the entire double jeopardy concept of multiplicity. Your Honor, appellant contends that wrongful sexual contact is a lesser included offense of abusive sexual contact because it is impossible to prove abusive sexual contact without also proving all of the elements of wrongful sexual contact. The two elements that might appear to not be present in the abusive sexual contact offense would be wrongfulness of the contact and that the victim in the case did not consent. I think logic would dictate that if wrongfulness means without lawful justification or excuse, then you would have to have that element met in order to succeed in a prosecution for abuse of sexual contact. That if the contact was lawful, then it could not also be unlawful.
Are you arguing that it's implied?
Yes, Your Honor. That.
And haven't we been reluctant to adopt implied elements in the last several years?
Your Honor, I think this counsel's view of this court's rulings could be interpreted that way, but I don't believe that this court's rulings have to necessarily be read that way, that what we're ultimately trying to do is determine what congressional intent was by reference to the congressional elements.
No, we're trying to discern what Congress said, that this, what the statute says.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, what's the point then of having the language in wrongful sexual contact that there was no legal justification or lawful authorization? Under your theory, that would have no meaning if we were to imply wrongfulness in every offense.
Your Honor, I think that when the drafters created the elements in the manual for courts martial, they were trying to distinguish that not every contact that's done for an abusive purpose or in order to satisfy the sexual desires of some person would constitute a crime, that contact must also be wrongful, which of course is implied in the other sorts of sexual offenses. So wrongful sexual contact, if it did not have that additional element, then the first element, the specific intent sort of element that the accused had the intent to abuse, to harass, or to satisfy sexual desires, that alone would constitute the offense of wrongful sexual contact. So the drafters had to specify that, no, this contact must be wrongful, and this contact must be without consent. Otherwise, that first element would satisfy the offense in and of itself, which was not Congress's intent.
Okay, well, let's go to prejudice. The judge did merge the specs and cut the tie. So where's the prejudice?
Your Honor, the prejudice, of course, would first lie in subsequent convictions, and if it's barred by the Double Jeopardy Clause, then there would be some that you've suffered two convictions where you should have suffered one. But beyond that, the military judge, you're correct, Your Honor, did merge the sentences for purposes of calculating the maximum punishment which could be imposed. But the military judge never told the sentencing authority that had been done.
Right, but did anybody ask him to? Did anybody object to the instruction he gave?
No, Your Honor.
They didn't?
No, Your Honor.
Well, so where does that leave us?
That leaves us with the members having been instructed that they must impose cumulative punishment for all the offenses of which the appellant was convicted, including an offense which appellant believes was a lesser included offense of another charged offense. And so you have a Fifth Amendment violation where the appellant has suffered cumulative punishment for...
Isn't failure to instruct waive the issue? Doesn't failure to object to an instruction waive the issue on appeal?
Your Honor, the...
Quite apart from the waiver I was talking about earlier.
Yes, Your Honor, failure to instruct...
Failure to object to the instruction, the proposed instruction.
Yes, Your Honor. However, I think we still have a constitutional issue which would still allow this court to review for plain error unless the failure to object was knowing and intelligent. It's sort of the same philosophy that we could apply.
Was he as confused on this one as he was confused on the other one?
I think it's fair to presume that the trial defense counsel was confused regarding the multiplicity issue throughout the proceedings, Your Honor. Your Honor, barring any additional questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Chief Judge, may I ask a question?
No. Yes, of course.
Counsel, in its brief, the government asserts the following. It says, by making a motion for unreasonable multiplication of charges, the appellant tried to create a situation where he could knock the consent specification off of the charge sheet and then escape liability by attacking whether the victim was truly incapacitated. Essentially saying trial defense counsel was gaming the system and should not now benefit from having gamed the system. What's your reaction to that?
Your Honor, my position would be that there is an exception to the double jeopardy prohibition on charging a greater and a lesser included offense in the same case. The exception would be where the government believes there's insufficient evidence to prove the greater offense, But that still doesn't allow you to proceed to an actual conviction on both offenses. That at that point, it violates the double jeopardy clause. The government can offer both theories, but the court, the military judge, should not permit the members to enter findings on both a greater and a lesser included offense. So I don't see evidence in the record to indicate the trial defense counsel was trying to game the system. The evidence in the record appears that trial counsel intentionally, not the trial counsel, but the prosecuting authority, charged with what they thought looked a lot like a lesser included offense. That's what trial counsel stated.
Is there any evidence of bad faith on the part of the convening?
No, Your Honor. There's no evidence of
bad faith. Well, then what's the point of this?
The point is that it appears the government charged a lesser included offense, believing that there may be some problems with their evidence of proving the greater offense. And impermissibly, in violation of the Fifth Amendment, that was allowed to result in subsequent prosecutions, two prosecutions for the same offense. And the members should have been instructed that they could only return a guilty verdict as to one or the other, but not both. Barring any additional questions, I'd like to reserve time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government, please.
Good morning. Chief Judge Baker, honorable judges of the court, may please the court. I am Major Daniel Green, along with Colonel Don Christensen. It is our pleasure to represent the United States in this matter. In response to the granted issue, it's the United States' position that, number one, this issue was waived by trial defense counsel, and two, even if it was not waived, the contested specifications are not multiplicious. Now, before getting to the waiver issue, I think an important contextual matter needs to be set forth, which is that the appellant in this case committed two distinct crimes. Because in this case, we didn't just have someone who was incapacitated, we also had a victim who manifested a lack of consent. And looking at the facts of this case, on four separate occasions, the victim was woken up, and on all four of these occasions, the appellant was told to stop and get away.
Well, now, that's an interesting proposition. On the one hand, the person is substantially incapable. On the other hand, the person is capable. Which is it?
Well, Your Honor, there are situations where it can be both. What she's entering, she's going in and out of state of consciousness.
Well, but I mean, isn't once enough? No means no. You know, then if she passes out, she's already said no. Her objection is registered in heaven, and that ends the matter, doesn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't think that it would end the matter when he's reinitiating. There was some issue as the time in between his incident.
Oh, okay. There's a temporal issue.
Yes, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, if the government wanted to, they could have charged for each particular instance, but they did not in this matter.
They did do diverse occasions, though, did they not? It's a noble fact that... The spec, is that correct? Is that not correct?
Spec 3.
Sure, I just want to confirm so I don't misspeak.
Because now you're up here arguing, well, this was one crime and this was the other. But how do you know which was which one who was charged that way? Well, sounds like you're covering the whole gamut, two to four incidents, by saying diverse occasions in each spec.
Right, they consolidated by using diverse, but they could have broken it out. If we were in a situation where they were truly going to overcharge, they could have broken each of them out, and then still would have had the consolidation percentage.
Right, you could have, but you didn't.
But they did not.
And now you're up here saying one clearly relates to incident number one, and one clearly relates to incident number three, or whatever, however you count up the two to four things that occurred. But how are we supposed to know that when the specification doesn't say that?
Well, the one specification refers to the incapacity, and the second specification refers to without permission. So based upon the without permission, that can deal with the situation of a lack of consent. And I think this was...
No, I understand, but you're...
Yes, Your Honor.
I thought your argument was There's two separate crimes here. One was the time when he went up to her when she was incapacitated, and the other time was the time when he went up to her when she was not incapacitated. But it wasn't charged that way. It was charged that as in diverse occasions, so everything's in play on each specification.
Well, Your Honor, he approaches her, she's incapacitated. He approaches her, she's incapacitated. He does that four separate times. He also approaches her on three separate times when she's manifested a lack of consent. What the government was doing here was they were...
So now there's seven separate incidents?
Well, there are four incidents that could have been committed either way. And when there are exigencies of proof, the government is permitted to charge those exigencies in order to make sure that they capture the conduct.
So the same facts support either charge. Is that what you're saying?
The same facts support both charges. But the manner in which the offense was committed took place when she was incapacitated, and it also took place after a manifestation of lack of consent.
Yeah, but so, the whole point of the incapacitated is that a person who's incapacitated, by definition, can't consent.
Yes, ma'am. But since she was going in and out of consciousness, she was able to manifest the lack of consent before she went back to sleep again.
If these are separate offenses, under your theory, did the military judge err by merging them for sentencing? Because generally you merge for sentencing when you have one set of facts that support two different offenses.
They weren't so separated enough that it wasn't his mens rea in this case was related to trying to have sex with her on that night. So for that basis, I can completely understand why trial counsel openly told the military judge, let's go ahead and merge these for sentencing.
But what is the theory behind charging both of these offenses? Why not charge one or the other?
Well, if you just charge the incapacity and you didn't charge the wrongful sexual contact, then the entire attack would be on whether she was incapacitated or not. And the whole issue of her telling him, no, stop, get away, and slapping him becomes irrelevant. As a matter of fact, what trial defense counsel tried to do in this case was use that as a sword in order to pierce the incapacity part of it. If you just charge the wrongful sexual contact without permission, then you're in a situation where the whole incapacity issue is less supportable. You're dealing with more of a focus on that lack of consent, which is why trial defense counsel went ahead and tried to attack that part of it by saying he was voluntarily intoxicated.
Boy, it sounds like the same thing to me. You can't consent. You didn't consent. I mean, here he is. Here she is.
And Your Honor, I could agree with you if this was one incident, or if it was just two after a brief time, but in this case, there are...
What are the temporal manifestations? How much time elapsed?
From the evidence in the record, it was unclear. It appeared that it was going on.
Okay, so there's some time variation, but nobody knows what it is, and it wasn't in the record.
She couldn't articulate how long it took. She could just articulate that enough time had passed for her to go back to sleep. And that's why this was put forward to the jury, for the jury to consider in this case, upon hearing all the evidence, how they felt that the incidents occurred, which enabled them to find him guilty of both.
Okay. The judge merged them, but he didn't instruct the members that he merged them. He didn't instruct the members. So this is in the 20 years I've been doing this, since I was an Air Force judge the first time, when multiplicity was the issue du jour, it has been one of the most confusing, messy areas of law in military jurisprudence. How are the members supposed to know what on earth they're supposed to do when the judge didn't tell them? Especially in an area like this where half the people who practice don't know what's going on.
My first answer to that is that it was waived because trial.
Yeah, but leaving waived aside, assuming arguendo it's not waived.
All right. assuming that it's not waived, the difficulty is that the members aren't looking at a charge sheet and determining time based upon the number of charges. What they're supposed to do is consider what happened that night, consider the character of the accused, aggravation, mitigation, and determining the sentence. In that regard, the military judge instructing them about, oh, okay, wait a second, there were two charges, almost adds a layer, more of a layer of confusion.
So it was better for the judge to say nothing because he would have just confused them more.
In this case, with the number of defendants...
In the area of multiplicity, less is more. Thank you.
Counsel, you're just talking about waiver, and that's your first position. But if a trial defense counsel misunderstands the applicability of a constitutional right, then can it be said that the defense counsel has knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived it?
Well, Your Honor, when you use the term misunderstands, that almost implies that he obviously misunderstood it. And as I pointed out in my brief that I wrote, the thing that struck me about this was the best tactical way for defense counsel to attack this case is through unreasonable multiplication of charges. He doesn't want an LIO. Because if he has the LIO, he's still going to have to argue against abusive sexual contact, and he's still going to have to argue against wrongful sexual contact. So it could quite reasonably be that he didn't want this to be an LIO and was proposing that as a matter of law to the judge because that's how he wanted the law framed in this particular case. In a very different case, the same defense counsel may have a completely different theory if it would be in his client's interest.
But didn't the judge indicate that his reading of Jones indicated that this wasn't an LIO in their discussions?
That is exactly what the judge informed both counsel. And in terms of the waiver issue, in looking at United States v. Lloyd, 46 MJ19, the issue is waived in an instance like this where the defense counsel says it's not an LIO, unless the charged offenses could be seen as facially duplicative, and that's facially the same reviewing the language of the specification and the facts apparent on the face of the record. In looking at the specifications, they do not appear to be facially duplicative, and based upon the facts of the case with the intermittent assaults that were occurring, they wouldn't be facially duplicative in that regard either.
Now, what was argued at the CCA? The CCA starts talking about multiplicity, and then they immediately veer off into unreasonable multiplication. What did the CCA hold? I think they held that there wasn't unreasonable multiplication. Is that all they held? Well, you know, of course, unreasonable multiplication isn't before us. Only right. Multiplicity is.
Well, in my reading of their decision, they decided the multiplicity issue.
But they decided it using an unreasonable multiplication of charges analysis.
Yeah, they talked about Quiros and, yeah, I mean, are we?
Right, but they devolved into it, and that's part of their discussion where they talked about how the charges cover different criminal acts. They veered into a multiplicity aspect of this. So as much as that may not be, in terms of form, the best way to get it forward, they did address the issue in that regard. Now, in terms of looking at whether offenses are multiplicious using an Alston-Jones analysis, unless the elements of the lesser offense are a subset of the elements of the charged offense, they will not be multiplicious. And here, as was discussed during defense counsel's argument, first of all, the element of wrongfulness is not part of abusive sexual contact. And also, in this particular case, looking at the facts, as I argued earlier, there were different assaults based upon different levels of capacity of the victim at the time. So it really left the government with a difficulty on what they could have charged in this case, as we discussed with whether they were limited with just one charge. They're really hamstringing themselves as to how the members are going to view this in terms of whether this is an actual manifestation of a lack of consent or whether this is a situation that involves true incapacity. And if it wasn't one charge, there could have been confusion as to the basis of conviction. Was it incapacity or was it a manifest lack of consent? So in those regards, it is the United States' position that it is not multiplicious. Are there any further questions? May I briefly conclude?
Of course.
Your Honors, we respectfully request this court find that the issue was waived by trial defense counsel, that even if it was not waived, the offenses are not multiplicious, and that this court affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Judge. The first issue I'd like to address is whether there are, in fact, two distinct crimes here. I think what's important is that the Blockberger line of cases discourages courts from referring to the facts in an individual case in order to try and assess what the statutory elements of an offense are. What the appellant has raised, what this court granted on, is purely a double jeopardy clause analysis where we look at the statutory elements and line them up without regard to the facts. And I would respectfully contend that that's the task that lies before the court. Without regard to any of the facts, do you have to prove wrongfulness and lack of consent impliedly in order to have a conviction for abuse of sexual contact? And of course, the opponent's position is that logic dictates that you do, that you cannot have a conviction for abuse of sexual contact if that contact had lawful justification or excuse, or if this supposedly incapacitated victim somehow was able to give lawful consent. That if you have those facts in a case, you cannot have a conviction for abuse of sexual contact, and therefore wrongful sexual contact is a lesser included offense. And that's purely looking at the statutory elements without regard to the facts, which is what's required under the double jeopardy clause. The question of whether the members would have been confused regarding what to do in sentencing, the appellant's position is that the members were not confused. The members were told by the military judge exactly what they were required to do, and that is to adjudge cumulative punishment for all three offenses of which the appellant had been convicted, including a greater and lesser included offense. There's no reason for any court to believe that the members did anything other than what the military judge had told them to do, which is to punish appellants cumulatively for offenses which violate the double jeopardy clause. The question of whether defense counsel was misunderstood and whether this was knowing an intelligent waiver, I'd ask this court to really consider the fact that trial defense counsel did raise a motion alleging multiplicity for sentencing, which of course this court has found in Campbell is equivalent to raising a motion for multiplicity under the double jeopardy clause. That there is no distinction, and trial defense counsel raising a motion for multiplication of sentencing and not understanding that that is raising a motion for multiplicity is prima facie evidence of being mistaken regarding the law. And that dictates against a finding that there was no intelligent waiver in this case. Barring any additional questions, Your Honor, I'd like to briefly conclude.
Please.
It will always be impossible for the government to prove the greater offense of abusive sexual contact without proving the lesser offense of wrongful sexual contact. In this case, both of those offenses were separately charged for the same acts, which is the sort of successive prosecution that the Supreme Court in Brown versus Ohio said is forbidden by the Fifth Amendment. The appellant asked this court to dismiss the lesser offense and remand for either a sentence rehearing or reassessment.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel, and we will stand in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30. Thank you.
All rise. Court stands adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.